this lesson that we're going to talk about today, we have to go back to last week where Joseph has been reunited with his brothers. Of course, when they realize who he is, they're fearful of their lives, and Joseph shows his true character and integrity as he had already shown Potiphar and Pharaoh as well. He forgives his brothers. He gives them assurances that what they had meant to be evil, God had meant for good, and not to fear him, not to fear the revenge that some would assume would come. And as we were leaving that lesson last week, Jacob, the father who had thought for all those years, 20 years, that Jacob or Joseph had died, finds out that he's still alive and in Egypt, and they bring Jacob to Egypt to meet his son again. And of course, we know that Joseph has set aside some of the best land in Egypt for his father and brothers to stay during this famine time so that they can grow their crops and feed their babies and multiply and things of this nature. So that's where we left it off. Well, we pick up today at this final stage. Several years obviously have passed, and the families have grown, the families have prospered during these horrible times. The famine is over, and though they still live there in the land of Goshen, they have not at this point gone back to the land of Canaan. They're still there in Egypt, and Jacob is getting older and older, and he's to the point where he knows that he's going to die. Remember his father, Isaac, when he thought he was going to die, and he called in his sons, Jacob and Esau, to give them, you know, to speak to them. He wanted Esau in to give him the blessing. Remember when Jacob deceived him and he got the blessing, and by the time Esau came in afterwards, Isaac said, "I have no more to give. This is all that I have." Jacob's going to do something a little different. Whereas Isaac had the blessing that he was going to bestow upon one child, the eldest, and sadly his favorite, Esau, he had nothing left to give after that one blessing. Jacob's going to do something different. He's going to bring all 12 sons in because he feels this is his final days, and he's going to bless every one of them. He's got a blessing for all 12 sons. Now, some of these blessings are not encouraging. Some of them are discouraging in regards to Reuben, his oldest, where, you know, Reuben had sinned against his father early on, and even though his father has forgiven him because of that sin, Reuben is not going to receive an encouraging blessing. His blessing is that you're not going to excel. Your people will never excel and be prosperous. He goes down the line of all the sons, telling them what the prophetic statement of blessing is upon them. He talks about Levi and the others, that Simeon, who they have a discouraging one because they were ruthless and they were destructive. So he talked about how that they would have a very small portion of land when they go back, and Levi, of course, is going to be taken away by God to set aside where they don't have land. They are going to be the priesthood. So he goes through all 12 of these sons, and he gets to Joseph, and he gives Joseph certainly the blessings of prosperity and land and everything. And we know later on that Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, will get the largest part of the land of Canaan in their inheritance when Joshua crosses them over the River Jordan, the children of Israel, and they inherit the land. And it's by lot that they choose, and Joseph's sons get the majority of the largest portion of the property. So, with all that stated, Jacob is ready to die. He's given the blessing out to all of 12 of his sons, and as he's there, you pick up in verse 29, he said, and he charged them and said unto them, his sons, you have to picture they're all gathered around him, charged them, saying, "I am to be gathered unto my people." That doesn't sound discouraging. That's a man who's getting ready to die well. When he is saying, "I'm coming to the point of the end of my life. I'm getting to the point where I'm to be gathered unto my people." He's, in a way, that is the part of dying well. I'm going to where they are. This was before Jesus Christ came to die for us, to give us eternal life in heaven. And this is wherever, to Jacob, wherever his ancestors are, that's where he's going to go. It's a reflective time for him, and not necessarily a sad one. You know, death can be very sad to people. If they know that they're going to pass away, it can be very sad of the terminality of it or the ending of it. But to him, I'm going to go and be gathered unto my people. Wherever they are, I'm going to be. I remember my father Isaac. I've heard of my grandfather Abraham. I'm going to go where they are going to go. And he's encouraged by it, by saying that. So the charge he makes of them is, bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite. This is the cave that Abraham, when Sarah died, Abraham was in the land of Canaan, and he wanted to find an appropriate place to bury his wife. And he, in his foreknowledge, wanted a place where not only she could be buried and be unharmed by animals and people and all this, he also knew that he would be buried beside her and possibly even his offspring. So he found a cave, apparently in this particular area of Hebron, today known as Hebron, which is about 20 miles south of Jerusalem. He found, it's a series of caves, and he found a cave there, and it was owned by the owner at the time was a Hittite man who actually had affections toward Abraham and was not willing to even sell it to him. I'll give it to you. Abraham says, I want this cave, I want this piece of field, I want to buy it from you. Oh, you don't have to buy it. I know what kind of a man of integrity you are. You can have it. But Abraham says, no, I'm going to buy it. I'm going to do the proper thing, and he bought it, the Bible tells us. And with that, he went into the cave and he buried Sarah, his wife. And then when he passes away, Abraham's going to be there. Now, in this cave, as we go in verse 30, it says, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field of Ephron the Hittite for a possession of a burying place. And in this particular place, not only is Abraham and Sarah buried, but Isaac and Rebekah are buried there, and Leah, which is Jacob's first wife. It's not the one he wanted initially. Rachel is buried somewhere else where she passed away. She passed away at a place where they had to bury her, and she is buried separately, but Leah is there. Jacob wants to go back to this place of his father's and be buried in the same cave where Abraham's bones are there, and Sarah, and then Isaac, and Rebekah, and Leah are there. And this is where Jacob, he tells his, in these verses, he tells his sons, I've prepared the place. I've already dug the tomb. I've already prepared my resting place, and I want you to take me out of Egypt that I have been for these years, take me back home, and I want you to bury me in that cave. Kathy, go ahead and throw this picture. This is about about 2,000 years ago, Herod the Great, this is the father to the Herod that we know of Jesus' day, the mean Herod. His father was called Herod the Great. He was a great builder. He was the Herod who actually built the temple. The Temple Mount was established, of course, by Solomon and the Nehemiah and Zerubbabel. And then Herod the Great would come in and expand it and build it to its largest degree. He also went to this place that he had heard of. Herod the Great was part Jew, and he had heard about this cave, and he wanted to build a magnificent building over the top of the cave for all to see. And what you see in the center part of this, the largest building, this is the area of Hebron. And back in those days, I'm sure you would not have seen all of these houses and all the development that's taken place. This would have been all field and various caves throughout the hillside there. Where they believe that Abraham's cave is located is about five stories below that building in the ground. That's where the caves descended. And this particular Herod wanted to build something that would protect it, so he built this large building, one of the largest in Hebron, and you can go there today and visit there. If you make it to Israel, you can actually visit the Cave of the Patriarchs. And in here, they believe that they actually have where the bones are. Now, of course, I don't know in my limited study on it, I did not read where they had. I knew they had found bones that had gone back thousands of years, but I don't know how they would have ever determined whose bones and things of this nature. But they do have evidence of bones in this area that go back to that time period of Abraham. Show the second clip there, Kathy. And inside, if you go inside of this building, there's apparently, you see the gates that are protecting it. Under this this decorative stone is apparently an ancient stairwell, that rock stairwell that goes down about five stories into the earth where the caves are underneath. And at the time, apparently, if you remove this, there's even a smaller hole to get in there. And about 50 years ago, when they really wanted to do some archaeological study, they said the hole was so small that a man couldn't get in it. So they had to lower a 12-year-old girl through this little opening, and where she would go down, and she would, tough little girl, would go in the caves, and she was apparently very good at drawing, and she would draw what she would see and things like this, and they would bring her back up, and she would tell what she had saw. She probably, I don't know if at 12 years old, if she knew the significance of going down into the cave of the patriarchs and looking around and seeing what she can see. You know, when you have spare time, it would be noteworthy to go and just Google Cave of the Patriarchs. You can read all about it, the history and everything. It's very fascinating. But this is where Jacob is wanting to go, not to this building, of course, but to the cave that could have easily you could have entered at those days to be buried. Now, it says in verse 33, "And when Jacob had made an end of commanding his sons," or giving them, you know, the knowledge of their blessing, "he gathered up his feet into the bed and yielded up the ghost." Man, he could even trigger in a way. If you read that straightway, he knew right to the very breath that he was going to, I'm done here. I'm going to pull my feet in my bed and I'll see you later. I mean, I wish I had that kind of control. But, you know, a lot of the scholars believe that this is more of some symbolic language, where he knew that his time was short, and he had sat on the edge of his bed to give his blessings as he puts his hand on their heads. And then after that, he goes, covers himself back up, knowing that his time is short. But the Bible tells us that he breathed his last, he yielded up the ghost, and was gathered unto his people. So he's dead. And if we continue reading chapter 49, we realize that, and the first part of chapter 50, the last chapter of the book of Genesis, we see that Joseph hears about it and weeps, as all of them did. They're mourning the death of their father. You know, death in those days was to be mourned. They had certain rituals that they would operate with. And if you see death in the Middle East today, on television, on the news, you will see that there is a very emotional outcry, an outpouring of emotion with any death these folks have. But obviously this was something that meant a lot to them. And Joseph, knowing what his father wanted, to go back to the land of Canaan and be buried, he was going to make it happen. He had the power to do it, but he wanted to ask permission to do it. And in the first part of chapter 50, he asked Pharaoh, through some of his officials, to go to Pharaoh and ask a favor of him, that my father Jacob, who even Egypt appreciated. They loved Jacob himself. I mean, even though he was not Egyptian, and normally Egyptians and Hebrews did not mix, even they had some affinity towards Jacob, simply because he was the father of who they basically had adopted as one of their rulers, Joseph. So as Joseph goes and asks permission to take his father back, Pharaoh gives that. And I want to read a little bit here. And it says, "And Joseph fell upon his father's face and wept upon him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians of the day." These are Egyptian physicians, to embalm his father. He knew immediately when his father said, "I want you to take me back." That's 275 miles from Egypt back to Hebron. Now, if you're walking, it's going to take a while to go 275 miles by foot. So Joseph, who Egyptians had been the ones to perfect the embalming process, he tells the physicians, "I want my father to be embalmed, because we're going to take him on a trip that's going to take a while, and in 4 days he'd already be decaying and stinking without this." So they embalm Jacob, the first of the patriarchs who actually go through this process. "And 40 days were fulfilled for him, for so are fulfilled the days of those which are embalmed." It either takes 40 days to embalm them, or something of that nature. "And the Egyptians," these are the Egyptians now, "mourned for Jacob 70 days. For 70 days, Pharaoh said, "We're going to go on to a time of mourning for this father of our Joseph. We're going to mourn the death of Jacob, who's not one of us, but he's the father of Joseph, who has done so much for us. So 70 days of mourning was symbolic of what they would normally do for a Pharaoh's death. If Pharaoh died, you had your mourning. And back then, Egyptians did not like facial hair and things, but they would grow whatever would grow, and they would not partake of certain things, certain luxury food items. They would go through a time of mourning. And they're going to do this very thing to Jacob because of Joseph. So they enjoy that time together of mourning as a people. It's come a long way later on when a Pharaoh comes on the scene that does not know Joseph. But right now, the Pharaoh who does know Joseph respects him so much that he gives this day of mourning, these 70 days of mourning, to his father. And after that, they begin on their journey, to take him back to this field. So we pick up in your lesson text, chapter 50, verse 7. It says, "And Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, all the house of Joseph, and his brethren, and his father's house." This is quite a procession. "Only their little ones or young ones and their flocks and their herds did they leave in the land of Goshen." He's telling Pharaoh, "We're coming back. I'm going to come back. I'm taking my whole family. I'm taking my servants, the officials that I'm over. We're all going to this huge procession." He tells us later that he took chariots and wagons. I mean, this is kind of the first funeral procession. We're used to that here. We have a long line of cars that follow going from where the ceremony was to the place of burial, and you've got this long line of cars following. It started right here with Joseph. He was going to put together a procession that would take him from Memphis in Egypt all the way to 275 miles away to this cave, and this procession followed. But he was going to leave some of their younger ones there to tend the flocks and stay in the land of Goshen, and he told Pharaoh, "We will be back," and that was evidence that he would. Now, the interesting part about this, too, that I was wanting to refer back to the tomb or the cave, the sad part about the history, and I guess I wanted to include this because it's with everything going on over there, to a point, when Islam became a predominant religion in the Middle East, and through the conquest they had, when they conquered the lands, they prohibited the Jews from visiting this cave of the patriarchs, because they believe, of course, through Ishmael, that their father was Abraham as well. And it's interesting, when you read the Bible of the death of Abraham, it says both Isaac and Ishmael buried Abraham together. They buried him in this cave together, two nations, and the Muslims, who are Arabs and predominantly, they would prohibit the Jews from going through there. And then as the lands would conquer back and forth, the Jews were never able to completely own this cave, and they still today do not. It's basically located in the West Bank, which is, you've got about 700 Jews that live there amongst 200,000 Palestinians, and the Palestinian Authority, governs the cave, and they only allow Jews to go and worship there on certain days, 10 days out of the year, and they can only go to the section of the building that gives honor to Isaac, which is their father, not to the rest of it. So they are still restricting Jews to a certain degree. Now, as a tourist, you can go and you can visit the whole thing. You can pay your tourism fee and you can go and you can go through the whole building. But there's that animosity there, and it's sad, but it just shows you the conflict that has continuously been throughout all the ages, even to the point of where the burial place of Abraham and the patriarchs are. I wanted to bring that up because it's played into this whole thing that we're seeing play out in the next few weeks with this with Israel getting ready to go into that West Bank area. All right. So as they gather this procession and they go to this cave, it says his sons did unto him according as he commanded them. They buried him in the cave, and they sent, and as they returned back to Egypt, the sons began to talk to themselves. Jacob's gone. He was our protector. He was the one that we believe the reason that Joseph didn't seek revenge on us because he didn't want to anger or bereave his father. So now that Jacob's gone, the 12 sons or the other sons are saying, I know what's going to happen. Joseph's now going to turn on us after all that we did to him, and he's going to seek revenge. So they concocted a story, and they sent messengers of their families to Joseph and said, we overheard our father say, give a command that you are not to seek revenge on us. You know, we heard this straight out of our father's mouth, that you were not to seek revenge. When he was giving us our blessings, this is what he told us. Now, Joseph wasn't at the blessing table. He was still doing his affairs. He would speak to Joseph. He would give Joseph a blessing, but Joseph wasn't there. So Joseph is to either believe this or not believe this, but he doesn't have to, because Joseph and his character never intended to seek revenge on his brothers. But they are not so sure, and they are trying to do whatever they can to bring to his attention that this was still their father's wish. But as they sent a messenger unto Joseph, saying, thy father did command before he died, saying, so shall you say unto Joseph, forgive, I pray thee, the trespasses of thy brethren and their sin, for they did unto thee evil. And now, we pray thee, forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of thy father. And Joseph wept when he spake unto them, because he had no intentions of doing that. And his brethren also went and fell down before his face, and they said, behold, we will be your servants. They're still trying to convince him. And it's interesting. Remember when Joseph was a youngster, and the reason they didn't like Joseph as older brothers, because he always would tell them the dreams that he had, and these dreams always kind of showed them bowing down to him. Remember, one of the dreams he had was that the 11 stars and then the sun and the moon would bow down to me. And I had this dream that 11 stars and the sun and moon all bowed down to me. And isn't that interesting? And the brother said, I can't stand this kid. You know, he's wanting all of us to bow down to him. And even Jacob says, why do you give me all these, you know, even your mother and father are going to bow? Now the sun and the moon have passed away. They're dead. So that leaves 11 brothers. And right here, not knowing it, they've just fulfilled his dream. Those 11 stars have come and they've bowed before him. The sun and moon are gone, and the 11 stars are bowing before Joseph, fulfilling the dream he had when he was 17 years old. And Joseph said unto them, fear not, for I am in the place of God. I am where God wanted me to be all along. What you have done, you know, may have been evil, but God has turned it for the good, because I am standing where he's wanted me to stand from the beginning and doing what he has asked me to do, because it was a purpose for it. It says, but as for you, you thought evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring to pass as it is this day, to save many people. God wanted me, God wanted the Jewish people, person, the Joseph, that he gave Abraham the promise that through your seed, nations will be blessed. Those that bless you will be blessed, and those that curse you will be cursed. And many nations will be blessed by you. Joseph is in the role of blessing other nations, because he's prepared for the years of famine to pour out the blessings of what Egypt can grow onto all these other nations. And it's through Joseph and his knowledge that is taking place. Now, therefore, fear not, I will nourish you. I'm going to take care of you while you're here, and your little ones. And he comforted them and spake unto them kindly. So that finally, after all these years, the brothers can rest assured that their father, who they thought was a protector of them, is gone. But it was always Joseph's integrity and character to forgive, and to walk away from any form of revenge when the revenge was clearly in his hands. He had every ability and every right to pour out the revenge, but his character was of a point where revenge was, he saw the reason for where he was located. He saw the purpose of God and where he was at, and therefore there was no desire, no sense of revenge in his heart at all. And now the brothers, after all these years, can rest easy, grow their families there in the land of Egypt, multiply greatly while Joseph is still in the role that he is there. Now, from verse 21 to the rest and the end of chapter 50, We don't know much more about Joseph's life in Egypt. He's going to live 56 more years. So he's going to die at 110 years of age. So he's got 50 more years of living in his role working under Pharaoh for the land of Egypt. His brothers, through these 50 years, they're still going to have several generations. It even tells us that Joseph, I think it was in verse 22, it says, "And Joseph saw up to the third generation of his own son Ephraim." So he's seeing his own posterity grow into his great-grandsons. And he is seeing that, you know, this is going to be the sons of Jacob. We are turning ourselves into a nation of our own. From 12 sons to now, I can see them out there in the plains of Goshen, and they're multiplying rapidly, and they're brethren, and they're not intermingling with the Egyptians. They're living amongst themselves and as they grow. But as those 50 years end, and all the great things that Joseph may have done, we get to the point where he himself feels like it's time, that his time is up, and he's going to pass away as well. So in verse 24, it says, "And Joseph said unto his brethren." Now, there's been quite a bit of debate here on what this means. He was the second to the youngest of all the brothers. Now, does this mean all of his brothers were still living and he's going to be the first one to die? We don't know. We don't know if the brethren here is referring to the nation of Israel at that time, all the sons and daughters of the 12 sons. We don't know. He says unto his brethren, "I'm going to die, and God will surely visit you." He's telling, and that's where they think he's just talking about the brethren. He's talking about all the descendants that are there. He's given a command or a statement, kind of what Jacob is going to do to his 12 sons. Joseph is going to do, because of his position in Egypt, he's going to pronounce over all the children of Israel that are out there living in the land of Goshen. "I'm going to die, but God will surely visit you." The book of Hebrews rewards Joseph in their hall of faith. Remember when they start listing all these folks of faith in the Old Testament, of all the ones that had the faith. And it was to build our own. As we read the writer of Hebrews' statement about all these great patriarchs and what they showed with their faith, that writer picked this particular point to bring Joseph up. When they talked about Joseph on that hall of fame of faith, they didn't talk about necessarily Joseph's, you know, his faith and believing in God when he was cast into the pit and when he was on his time in the Pharaoh's official ranks. They picked the time when he spoke to his posterity, to all the ones that were out there, when he says, "God will surely visit you," meaning God's going to be with you, and he's going to bring you back to your land of Canaan, the promised land. Joseph didn't do it. Joseph didn't let him. We don't know why he went back or he didn't go back. We don't know why Joseph didn't allow the children of Israel to go back to the land of Canaan while he was alive. We don't know that kind of information, but we know that he's telling them, this is going to happen. He's going to bring you out of this land unto the land which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. That's the hall of fame faith that they're praising Joseph for. Is Joseph knew that I'm here for a reason. I brought them out to preserve them through this famine and all that. They're going to multiply here, but God will keep them together, and he will return you back to the land that he promised the patriarchs. That was the faith that he had. So much so that Joseph took an oath to the children of Israel, saying, "God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. I want to go with you. I have so much faith in our God that, yeah, you're growing fat on the land here, but I know that God's promise was for you to inhabit the land of Canaan where your ancestors are buried, and that's going to happen. And when you go back, I want you to pick me up and take me with you. Because even though I've lived the majority of my life," he lived 17 years in the land of Canaan. He's lived the rest of those 100 years or so, 90 years in Egypt doing what God called him to do. "But when I die," I'm going to die now, "and I'm going to stay here with you. But when you go, I want you to pick my bones up and take them with you. And it says that, and so Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him so that his body would not decay. And he was put in a coffin in Egypt. They didn't bury him in the ground. They didn't bury him in a cave. They put him in a coffin ready for transport. Put him in a coffin that they could gather together whenever that day was going to take place. And they could put him on a wagon and take him back to his ancestral home. All of that predetermined by Joseph. This is what we want. I believe in my God. I know what he's going to fulfill. I don't know how. I don't know when. But I know it's going to happen, and I want this to be a word-of-mouth testimony that whenever y'all go from generation to generation, be it known unto you that I'm going to go back with you. And I'm going to be embalmed. I'm going to put myself in a coffin so that no animals can get to me, and you're going to take me back. No one at that time, other than possibly Abraham, when Abraham received the word from the Lord that his people would spend 400 years in a land that's not their own, Joseph may have known that, but I don't know if he would if he did or he didn't. But 400 years are going to pass, because as Joseph dies, and the children of Israel continue to grow and expand, and a new Pharaoh comes in that doesn't know Joseph, doesn't honor Joseph, doesn't know Jacob. All he knows is these people over here are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and they're going to form themselves into a mighty army, and they're going to overtake us, and we're going to enslave these people. And for 400 years, they are enslaved, growing the whole time. And from one generation to the other, they're telling the traditions of the land of Canaan, where their patriarchs are buried. They're telling the stories of how Joseph was placed in this place of honor so that he could preserve us. All the time that they're captured and enslaved, they're talking to each other, telling their children, telling their grandchildren, that the promises are that we're going to have a land of our own, and God's going to take us out of here. And our father Joseph, who is buried, or he's not buried, he's in a coffin somewhere in an Egyptian tomb or whatever, you know, we're going to take him back with us. And after 400 years, we know the story of Joseph, of Moses coming on the scene. And when Moses said, you know, when he did the contract with Pharaoh of we're not only going to leave, but we're going to take all some of the goods, the golds and the silvers and all of that from you, your people. But we're also, Moses knew for a fact, we're going to take that coffin that's been sitting there for 400 years with the bones of Joseph in it. We're going to take it back with us. And they carried that thing throughout all those years through the wilderness and all that. Joseph, who had preserved them, working along God's purpose, would go with those children of Israel all through the wilderness, and they would bring him back to his home. It's been a good group of lessons, because it shows us not only the promises of God, but the durability of God, no matter what we may do to mess it up, and how that God can take things that are evil and turn it around for good, because his purpose is secure and his purpose is going to take place. What we're seeing in Israel today has not taken him by surprise. We don't know what's going to come out of this in the next few weeks. We have no idea, but he does. We have no idea if it'll look bleak upon Israel if something were to happen. But we know that in the end, God will turn it around to fulfill his will and his purpose. We're going to stay with God. We're going to continue to pray for them, and we're going to pray for God's will to be done, and we're going to stay in his pathway no matter what happens. And we will see, once again, the same God that led these patriarchs through their lives is going to still lead their descendants today, even though so many of them reject him, reject his son. But yet his will is there, and he has a purpose for the future. So as we leave this set of lessons, next week we're going to turn the page completely, going from the historical account of Old Testament. We're going to spend the rest of the next six weeks talking about today's issues here in America, and how we as Christians are to take a stand on some of the issues that are so controversial and so prevalent and growing. The next few weeks, as I looked ahead, these are lessons that I myself am going to have to spend time because it's pretty easy to know where we stand with the Word of God on these issues. But I want us to really grasp on how these issues are changing society. And some of this is going to be uncomfortable to talk about. but we're going to do so. So we look forward to seeing you next week, talking about the sanctity of life, but then after that, we're going to get into some real controversy, but it's good for us to talk about this, and I look forward to seeing you in the next coming week. So have a good day, and get prepared to worship this morning, and we'll see you again.